Accession number 27813, Mr. Jack Ray, Reel 5. Now, what about, we get to the point where you come out of the solitary and go into the main camp. Now, you don't remember much about that, do you?
Very little, except the excitement of being able to talk to some of your fellow men and find that you had clean teeth again, that you'd had a shower and felt almost human again. That in itself was a huge morale booster. But then I had very little time to actually speak to many of them there or learn much about it, because within only two or three days we were told that we were being moved to another camp.
Now, what do you remember much about the journey? This is to Sagan, isn't it?
Yes. It was one of those physical shocks. That was my first sighting of cattle trucks and being marched into these things, in which had seven chevaux, 48 arm, seven chevaux sitting on the outside of it. And we were crowded into these things, really crowded in. And we had to ask the guards to just open a peep of the door to let some air in. It was suffocating within them. And we seemed to, I can't remember how long we were on, but it was two or three days at least that we were.
Conditions must have got pretty
bad. They deteriorate then. Very quickly in those conditions. They did stop occasionally for comfort stops, but quite often it wasn't in time for some. And conditions do deteriorate when you get jammed into those conditions.
Now, where were you going? You were going to...
It turned out we were going to Stalag Luft 3, but as I was very much of a new boy, I didn't know the language, I didn't know what Stalag Luft 3 or anything else meant. I just knew we were going into a camp which the Germans informed us that was a luxury camp and we were just going to be well looked after, and painted a very rosy picture of it. When I asked the guard what we're going to do there, he said, you dig tunnels and we find them. So that was so I gathered it was that sort of camp.
Do you know what month you got to Sagan?
I'd have to work that out from when I shot down, but it was probably around about November, I would think.
Now, what was your reception? You were going into North Compound, weren't you? Can you describe the sort of setup as you saw it when you arrived?
I didn't quite know what I was expecting to see, but we were sort of routinely put into a complicated double gate system, which I've noticed that they had one set of gates, one set of guards, and then you went through that to a second one. And I realized I was getting into a fairly sort of highly security basis camp. And there were large numbers of our own fellow airmen that had been prisoners. They were all crowding around the gate, watching this come in, I suppose, trying to see if they could see any of their friends and so on. And occasionally there was a shout and a wave. And I didn't really know whether I was going to know anyone or not. And then when they sort of took us through, of course, their typical German efficiency, the first thing we went through is checking what we had on us. Took away my cigarette lighter was a good example, and for some reason they weren't allowed cigarette lighters in that camp, and some other gear. Then they took photos. They made a thorough record of you, and then you walked into the camp. And I looked around and trying to see someone that I knew, and there was a sort of excitement and yelling by some. And then suddenly I saw somebody I knew, and it was a wonderful to see a face from one of my old squadron friends, and that was Mick Shand. And of course I rushed over to old Mick, and we had a great chat for a very short space of time, and then for all reason he looked over my shoulder and rushed off and left me. And I thought, good God, has this fellow gone mad too? I couldn't, what had happened? And it turned out later I discovered that what had happened is that there was a horse dragging a cart around in that area, picking up rubbish, with a Russian sort of sitting beside it cleaning the rubbish in the camp. And this particular horse was just lifting its tail at that time. And Mick had rushed off, and he had a shovel in his hand and a flat bit of board. And he shot off, and he yelled at me as he went, so I've got to take this to my tomatoes fast. And so I thought this man has really gone nuts. And I thought camp had really affected him. But later I was to learn that priorities changed, and what was valuable outside of the camp was intensely valuable inside, and so slowly you begin to realize that life had changed somewhat.
Now, Did they put you through any security checks, the prisoners, before they accepted you? Because I know they did from your book, but and there's a story about this Jim Gunn story. I mean, what was the sort of, there's a two-stage procedure, wasn't there? The making sure you weren't a stooge or...
That's right. Of course, immediately after that, you were welcome to come into a room. You didn't know that was that they were really testing you. I didn't even think about it. But you finish up sitting in a room and meeting a lot of fellow prisoners, and they were hungry for news of home. Most of the chaps that I went to were British, and they wanted to know what it was like at home and how things were getting on and their family. In other words, we were their latest bit of news. So we were, for a short space of time, we were very popular. Once they dragged all the news out of us, then they tended to forget us. But at that point, we were welcomed into these rooms and some of their precious coffee and a cup of coffee with them. And I fell into a trap, unfortunately, at that one, because they were all English men that I was around, and they one of the chaps said to me, I said, you're in New Zealand, do you know a chap called Jim Gunn? And I said, yes, I knew Jim. Yeah, of course, that, suddenly I'd heard a familiar name, and it was quite exciting to hear it. I said, and so I went on, and I said, Tony, about a couple of weeks ago, I saw Jim. I said, we'd gone up to a station in the north of England, and on that station, I said, they were having a gay party we'd just missed where he'd got married. And he's going off on his honeymoon to London, so I was hoping I was going to catch up on Jim later, which I did. And I said, when I ran into Jim in London, he introduced me to his new wife, and I said, oh, boy, those two really looked happy and pretty tired from obviously the gay life they were having. And I said, where did you know Jim? And there was a sort of silence. He said, I've never knew him. He said, but he married my fiance. I never went back to that room again. Poor man.
Now, so that was a sort of all part of the informal and formal checking.
It was.
Could you describe the huts you were put into? Do you know the number of huts you were in?
I mean, I was going to ask you if you had a map planned somewhere, and I could have told you. I've forgotten the number of it now.
What could you describe the huts then, and the bed? You know, the layout and what they were like.
Even that memory's thin now, but.
I
went into a room that I think originally they were built supposedly for two people. There were eight in it, or seven plus me, as I went into this. And they were mostly Australian, one Rhodesian, and myself. The bunks weren't too bad. They had a sort of palliasse-type sheet that you could sleep in. The boards had got a little bit thin. I was learning later as to why there were not too many boards under you when you lay down. They had a good system within themselves. You each took your own duties. One fought either cleaning, cooking, you name it. It was a well-organized little group. But with eight men to get on together, that in itself was an interesting exercise. And but however, we were really quite well.
How did you get on with them then? I mean, tell us about that. The eight of you. I know there's something about irritating habits. Firstly, before we come up here, how well did you get on with them? You know, I mean, was it a natural thing?
Yeah, no, we did very well. Actually, we did. We got very well. They had already undertaken self-appointed tasks that they preferred, and so you fitted into the pattern of it. For some reason, I discovered I could cut the bread better and thinner than most of them, and I got the sort of permanent job. I think it was about 60 slices I used to manage to get out of a German loaf of bread. And so I suddenly got the permanent job of cutting the bread.
It was important to cut it accurately, I presume.
Yes, and I don't know why I acquired it, but all of a sudden that became a very important job. But we rotated cooking, we rotated cleaning of the place, and it was generally quite well-disciplined rooms.
And what about this business of irritating habits? You know, what about their irritating habits before we come on to yours?
Well, we had one chap that always sniffed. He had a permanent sniff. And just to drive you mad, he sort of dragged his nose back and dragged it back until you could have shoved him out of the room because you couldn't stand it. We had one hungry 6'6" of him Aussie in the room who loved wetting his finger and banging down and grabbing every bit of crumb of bread that you dropped or any other. They sound very petty, to listen to now, but at that time they nearly drove you mad. And each of these strange little habits they had built and built until you could just about thump the fellow for doing it.
You had one yourself, didn't you?
Yes, well, of course, among other things that we did in the prison camp was we saved matches, for example, by getting a thin razor blade and cutting them at least into four. One, if you could imagine how thin that match stick became. But you had to be very careful the way you lit them, because they sort of, you had to softly scratch it across the matchbox, and it quite often didn't light the first or the third, till about the fourth time you finally got the thing to light. I had one of my nasty little habits at times, I just loved to have a cigarette after I'd gone to bed and the lights were out and we're ready, and I'd love to just light that cigarette. Or out had come this box of matches, and I'd start scratch, scratch, scratch. And what I didn't know, that seven other men in that room were all just sitting there with their tents ready to explode, waiting for me to light that damn cigarette. And so finally I'd get a light and there'd be a deep sigh around the room. I didn't know that was that bad. But they finally exploded, and a bit of my cigarette at night, because they just couldn't handle it anymore. They sound silly today, don't they? But at that time they were immensely important to these fellows.
Now, what about food generally? What food did you get? And there's two sources, one the Germans and the other, well,
the Red Cross parcel.
You can grow and Red Cross parcel. Yeah. Firstly, what did the Germans give you?
Just the bread and margarine. First time I sort of seen, it was quite well before margarine, sort of jar margarine and some bread. Very, very rarely, perhaps once every 3 months or 4 months, a tiny ration of meat might come up. Don't forget, according to the Geneva Convention, they were supposed to feed us. That's a quite incredible thing. I'd have shuddered to think what would have happened if we depended on them. But the Red Cross parcels were pouring in, and if it hadn't been for the Red Cross parcels, we would have been very starved.
And what was in the Red Cross parcels?
Oh, margarine, tin of Spam. We always seemed to get that Spam. Or if it was a British parcel, then we had McConaughey meat, or bully beef, and there was milk powder, chocolate. They're all basics. And of course we had a system of keeping a certain amount out of it to just in case the Red Cross parcels didn't come next week, so we had to try and sort of ration it to a degree. But it worked pretty well.
You had a sort of exchange system for food, didn't you? Can you explain about that? Because you didn't use sugar, but can you just explain it?
Food Echo was a...
Food Echo?
Food Echo. I've never seen it quite written. I don't quite know how it was spelled. We used to call it Food Echo, and that it meant that you could... For example, I never had sugar in my tea or coffee at that time, but I always got my spoonful of sugar because the others were having it, and I'd keep mine just in a little empty tin, and save it up until I took it to the Food Echo, and then I'd say get an extra bit of chocolate out of it, or extra cigarettes, whatever. And so this exchange worked very well in the camp, and it developed sets of values. So a large number of the units within that Food Echo had sort of a point price, but there were others that had an escalating value if they were very short or highly valued.
And... So what about growing food? Was that important? I mean, or, you know, you talked about the tomato, but was that an important source of food or vegetables, or was it just a few?
No, that was just a special treat occasionally, more than anything else.
What about any other rations? Did you get anything else given? I mean, did you get a ration of cigarettes, or was that the Red Cross parcel?
We got through the Red Cross parcel. The Germans, actually, poor devils, they used to give a few dreadful cigarettes. They were, I think they were Russian tobacco. I don't know where they came from. They were horrible things. But we took them just out of principle so that they had a few less amongst themselves. But the poor old Germans that were passing on these Red Cross parcels, I think their ration was about 20 cigarettes a week. And we were smoking about twice as many of that a day at times. You know, so I often marveled how the Germans could open our Red Cross parcels and pass them over to us.
So, was the food centrally cooked or cooked by hut?
Say that again.
Was it centrally cooked at a big sort of kitchen, or was it cooked hut by hut?
It was mainly most of the food. We did have a cook's a center store, a sort of a cookhouse in the middle of the camp that was designed, of course, with the rationing. It was mostly spuds, potatoes, and a tiny bit of ration that they got occasionally for German, and about once, perhaps a fortnight, you might get a sort of a sloppy sort of bit of soup and with a bit of meat thrown through it. I'd have shuddered to think if we tried to live on that, but that was came through as a cook. But we had our own stoves in our rooms, which we had made from mainly from cans of beaten together, and they worked very well.
Well, I'll come back to that, because I know that you clean bashing was something you did. Yeah. So, what about the latrines? What state were they in?
Not too bad, except that we did have a flush toilet in each of the huts, but the main big toilets, because you could imagine, I can't remember the number that used to be in each hut, but you had no time to wait for that, for getting into it. So they had these sort of open things that you literally sat on, a crossbar of wood, and they were just open pits, which occasionally were emptied.
The one thing I do know is fuel to keep the huts warm, because you got there in winter. I mean, yeah. And I know you've got a story about how you got extra fuel. What was the fuel situation? Did you have enough fuel to keep the stoves going?
Not keep it going all the time. We had a ration of it. I don't know whether you're familiar with carbonets, but they were pressed coal, and theirs were shaped as sort of little rectangle blocks. And we got X number of those per week each for each room. And if you're very careful with your cooking, that's about all they last. You couldn't leave them burning all night. Of course, when the winter came, the huts used to get very close, cold. The ice, you could see icicles hanging down out just outside the window. It was cold.
And you managed to get some extra. Well, yes, not you, but your hut.
Yes, we managed to get extra because we had a pretty bright Aussie amongst us at the moment that the Germans had created a shower rooms, which was an added luxury. It wasn't in when we first came, but they did put it in this hut. And then these, throughout the camp, that we had about once every 2 or 3 weeks, you could line up in a queue and get in a hot shower. But the system had to be run by somebody, and this particular Aussie in our room volunteered to be the man to run the shower. And, of course, that meant that he had access to a huge amount of fuel that was fed into the shower area for heating up the showers. But we hadn't realized that he was a really smart boy, because he'd realized he had direct access to a huge amount of extra fuel. So suddenly our room became a luxurious room, nice and warm throughout the winter, as long as nobody else knew about it too much. Even amongst our own Kriegies, we didn't want to tell them too much about that one.
What about news, sources of news? You know, did you have camp radio?
Yes, every day we got daily news of the BBC and the Russian news. That was done by the little X, as they were known. That is, each hut had its own liaison with the escape organisation of X, and the little X in each hut was the chap that looked after security in that particular hut. And he was given a bulletin of the latest news, which been taken through our secret radio of the BBC news and also Russian. And of course, chaps had maps out. Practically most rooms had maps showing the position of soldiers. It used to puzzle the Germans how up to date we were, you know, because we also got the German newspaper, but quite often we completely disregarded that. The thing that probably actually annoyed us just a little bit, we found the BBC news was less accurate than the Russian. The Russian one seemed to be more up to date than even the British news. And so some chaps had alternate maps in the room, one with what the Russians told us what we believed, and one that anyone else told us we didn't quite believe.
What about recreations? I mean, we'll come on to the escape side separately. Mm. You know, some of the camps are really sophisticated, and you could take courses, you could do all sorts of things.
Yeah.
What did you choose to do as your main recreation?
Blow a saxophone. When I discovered that you could get hold of a saxophone, and I'd always had a probably latent desire to play one of these things, and I was amazed to discover that that you could get one. I won't say everyone could get one, but they knew, my friends seemed to know that there was one floating around and that they could get for me. And so I got this lovely tenor saxophone and some music, and there were quite a few chaps in the rooms that could play saxophones and could help you to a degree. But you had to go somewhere to play these things. So they had one little room nearby to a kitchen, and we all assembled in it. For example, I practically every day stood side by side with a chap trying to blow a bassoon, if you could imagine. So I had a bassoon booming one side of me and a chap trying to learn the horn on the other, and I'm trying to blow the saxophone in the middle. But strange enough, it used to do me good to go there and blow that, because it stopped me getting hopping mad with not being able to get out from the wire.
And did you make much progress?
No, I still can't play a saxophone.
What about any other things? I mean, did you do any of these courses you could do? You could do professional qualifications.
You could.
Did you do any of that?
No, but I had a desire to. I'd remembered from before the war, and I worked for for what we used to call a freezing company, in other words, an abattoirs. Within that was one or two chaps that used to tan and dye beautiful sheepskins, and they used to come out. I used to admire the condition of them, and I often, when I was lying in prison camp, I used to think that could be a wonderful industry for me to get into, to produce them. And so I made inquiries, and I was amazed to find that I could get a certain amount of books on tanning and dyeing, even in the camp. They had libraries, and what they couldn't get, they tried to get for me. It's quite incredible. I did get quite a lot of information in camp and studied it as much as I could.
But you couldn't take, you obviously couldn't have a practice actually doing
no,
it.
No, not physically at all. It was all
theoretical.
Yeah. Actually, you had to be a little bit careful. A lot of chaps, yeah, they even got degrees of accountancies and so on in camp studying, but it didn't do them much good because you had no relaxation. It was quite interesting. Some of the chaps that went intensely studying just about went round the bend, you know, because they just had no sort of compensation of relaxation.
Now, what about the theatre? You had a camp theatre. Did you take any part other than going to watch in any...
Oh, yes, well, because we all enjoyed it. We had some beautiful females there, you know. Some of these fellows so incredible that they collected wolf whistles every day they went out.
So you just watched the shows? You didn't...
I didn't partake myself, but a lot did get involved, yes.
And what sort of show would they be like?
Oh, some were classical type of shows. I couldn't tell you straight off, but Gilbert and Sullivan would come through. There's because at that time we still had quite a strong American and Canadian flavour, and of course we had Glenn Miller music nights and so on. We developed quite a good band, Glenn Miller band. My saxophone playing never got into it.
Now, what about sport? You were keen on sport.
Oh, yes.
What sporting activities?
Rugby was just great there. Because we had South Africans, it wasn't very long before we had intense competition against the South Africans. And the British team was pretty good as well. But apart from that, each hut had a football to a rugby team. It was a great relaxation.
I mean, did you have the gear? Or were you just playing a uniform?
Yes, we had football boots. We had the gear that all came through from Geneva.
And what standard of rugby was it?
Quite a high standard of rugby, considering that at times we were playing on ice-hard ground, just to make things a bit difficult.
And what position were you playing?
I was the hooker, which right in the middle of the scrum and at a fairly key position. So I sort of enjoyed my rugby very much.
Well, was it, did you get into the sort of, New Zealand team?
Oh, yes, against the South Africans, yes. And, of course, there was an international hooker against me, and he was too damn good. So we had to cheat to beat him.
So how would you do that?
Well, because you weren't supposed to hook from the side of the halfback was throwing the ball in. Of course, you were supposed to use the outside foot, not the near side foot. But as long as the ref wasn't watching, I used to use the near side foot and depend on the man beside me to drag the ball back. But that made the South Africans hopping mad, so they when they woke up to us, and so they unfortunately advised the ref. So it didn't last that long.
But was it quite a physical game? I would have thought.
Well, highly physical, yes. Oh, yes, it got pretty mean when you got out. But it was enjoyable, and we were all friends after it.
Any other recreations you remember?
I was amazed at the camp there where they actually were able to carefully rake out the ground just before winter set in, and my first sight I saw them being able to hose over the ground and make an ice rink. That was quite amazing, to be able to create quite a sophisticated ice rink just by hosing over a raked ground. And again, ice skates seemed to appear out of the blue from somewhere, and the Canadians then were into their... They were killers. We had no show, but we only had to stand on the skates and we were bowled over into a corner.
Did you have a go at skating?
We just had a go, but they got evens. We'd been giving them hell at rugby. They got more than evens when it came to ice hockey.
Any other sports? Cricket?
Cricket, yes, it was cricket. I was quite impressed with sand... what do they call it? Volley? I've lost the name of it.
Volleyball?
Just throwing just playing the ball over the net in sand. It's now an international sport. I can't think of the name now, but the Poles were particularly good at that.
So each country had their sort of...
They seem to get ascendancy somewhere, yes.
Right. So the next thing I want to ask you is about this clim bashing. Because, you know, one of your jobs in the camp was to use it. Now, could you explain? Clim is that the condensed milk or the dried and powdered milk?
Any tins. It's surprising how good you got at it. We used to take the handle off the door. That was our hammer. Naturally, the Germans didn't like the idea of giving you any hammers. And then you had you developed a knack of folding over one little edge of the tin after you'd broken them open and folding it over to the other one. And it's surprising you could make them just virtually waterproof and get a sheet of metal by carefully building them up. You needed to solder in odd areas. And so we made that with tiny little cans, like, say, fish paste or other little small cans, and fill them with margarine and put a bit of pajama cord or something in there as a wick. And you made then a blower, or made from another one, of course, that it rested on your chin, and you blew through this fine tube, and you got quite a hot flame at the end. It was quite amazing. And you could then melt the solder out of the cans, and that's how you got your solder from the very cans that you were playing with. And then we needed rosin, so we would... some of the old pine trees around, and we got bits of gum and stuff out of that, and we used that for a rosin, and we got pretty efficient with soldering.
And what would you be making with Climpton? So give us some examples of what you'd make.
Jugs, pans for frying, making cake pans. We made, of course, stuff for the tunnel as well, their ventilators. They needed the big ventilators, that was sort of specialist jobs. But all sorts of little bits that we needed for the kitchen. It's quite remarkable what we could make.
And how long a day would you spend doing that? I mean, was that a big activity?
Oh, no, it was just something that we did when it was needed.
So it wasn't every day, it was just as and when?
Yeah.
One thing I forgot to ask you is they gave you a sort of log book, a prisoner's log book that
yes.
people fill with drawings and things. Tell me about that. What exactly was it?
It was actually just a small handbook. It was actually, I think it was, I can't remember, it was the Red Cross or the YMCA. I'm not sure where it came from, but these books were something that you could do drawings in yourself. And even though you're not an artist, you still had to go at it. And there were... we had a brilliant artist in our room, and so if we were stuck and we wanted to get some particular effect in a drawing, we used to pour on. Bajelk Peterson used to do it for us. And so we had a lot of fun making all sorts of pictures as well.